Good evening, you guys. This is K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and at this time we begin the tech deck that's usually scheduled on Sunday evening at 8 o'clock. Most Sunday evenings for the last 29 and a half years, the odometer has just rolled over to a new number. This is tech net number 1400 of the series that began in September of 1982. I'm Dick, K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB. John and Dick try to gather the curious people who want to know more about how this stuff works. Our transmitters and receivers and feed lines and propagation, whatever. There's a lot to learn about wireless hardware and techniques and the philosophy. We can sometimes even get into the philosophy of it. I'm going to give you a little bit of a correction for something I gave you out last week. Let me drop. The first subject we discussed last week was oil burners, and for the very few who are willing to do their own service on their oil burners, we gave them quite a few hints as to what to do and what not to do. And I was telling you guys that there was a man who a decade or two ago had a contract from Brookhaven Laboratory to investigate the quality of the tuning of the oil burners of many of the homes on Long Island, and he came to the conclusion a lot of them were misset and not being properly maintained. That man was Erwin Dresner, W2TRP, and I couldn't think of his call letters. I also failed to mention that if you guys are going to do oil burner service, the very first thing you do is very similar. All the high voltage capacitors before you put your hand in there. In the case of an oil burner, make sure you disconnect the fuse or circuit breaker of the house that goes to the oil burner. Make sure that the big red switch on your cellar stairs are turned off. Make sure there is no power going to the oil burner before you do service. You can envision what would happen with the 10,000 volt ignition transformer in there. If the thermostat demands heat while you're doing service and it's powered up, not only are you subject to the 110 volt electrocution, but also the 10,000 volt, and then the oil starts squirting out, and it ignites while you've got things apart and your hands are in there, you can see it's a really bad scene. So if you're going to do any oil burner service, make sure that at least two ways in the world the power is killed, both by the big red switch and by the circuit breaker or the fuse that goes to the oil burner. One very important thing that we forgot. A person signs into the TechNet. Let me drop. I should mention that the subjects that we consider appropriate for the TechNet are essentially any subject that would be of interest to ham radio operators. Because in my opinion, a true ham radio operator is a bit of a scientist. There are many subjects that can interest them, even maintaining their own automobile or oil burners and things like that. So a person signs in by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just to let us know you're listening. Lots and lots of nets will take tremendously long lists of people that are listening. After 29 and a half years and after 200,000 hits on the website where you can listen to all the past recordings of the TechNet, by now we believe that there are people in the tri-state area listening to this. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. So please sign in if you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, Joe and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name and the word yes at this time. K2RIW. Okay, we got Jim. Who else?
Mike and yes.
Jim, yes.
Yeah, we know we got Wes. Mike, give me your call letters again, Mike.
Form Tango.
Okay, I got the Tango. Give me the call letters a couple of times, Mike.
AA2DUT, Kilo Alpha 2, Delta Uniform Tango.
Okay, Delta Uniform Tango. We got you, Mike. Okay, we got Jim number one, Mike number two. And who's going to be number three?
WS2N, Paul. Space Report. Good evening, sir.
Yeah, I know. We've got the Dragon has landed, and they've already talked about the nice new car smell that it's got inside, so we're going to be hearing about the new SpaceX launch to the International Space Station. Paul, our space expert, will giving us that information. I should mention that We try to answer everyone's questions briefly during the first hour, so in theory you don't have to wait more than an hour for an answer. And at the end of that hour, we have both the space report, and John gives us what we call Mel's Corner. In other words, people who write or email John with a question or a comment because they don't yet have a ham license, we handle two or three of those. And then beyond that first hour and a half that I just mentioned, hour for the questions, and then roughly a half hour or so for those other two items, we then go into the deeper subjects. So once again, so far we've got Jim, Mike, and Paul, who signed in. Anyone else give me your call letters? And Wes, anyone else give me your call letters right now? K2RIW.
The two NNL, yes. Respectfully, please put me on the top of the list. I have an announcement for 1 minute or less. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. NNU believes he has something of sufficient importance. He's going to go first. Mr. NNU, go right ahead. And I believe you're in Romania, K2RIW.
Right, Dick, I am in Romania quite early in the morning. I waited for this opportunity to make this announcement here. so here it goes. I listened to you, Dick, several times about talking the perils of ready pregnancy problems that we have, health hazards and whatnot. And I have to agree with you that RF radiation is not cancerogenic directly. Here we are totally in agreement. However, there are side effects that you are not taking them in consideration. Because I raised this possibility several times, and there was quite a negative reaction to what I was happy to say. I chose to write a paper. So if anybody wants to know about my notions about radio frequency perils, our pollution, and how we're going to go down, please go to QRZ.com and you will find there a link to an article called "There Was No Apple in Eden." So this is my announcement, Dick. Thank you so much for your time. Go ahead.
Very fine. That was Alex by EchoLink. From it used to be Alex from Yonkers, but now Alex is living in Romania, and apparently I know that Alex has had some rather strong feelings on the subject of radio frequency biohazard. He and I have had quite a few discussions on that, and it's been a subject that will never thoroughly end. It'll always be a slightly open subject. I'm using as a primary reference the IEEE C95 standard from the Institute of Standards from the United States. The IEEE, if I can think of the name for the C95, it's not quite the Bureau of Standards, but anyhow, it's a 60-year report that represents all of the best thinking and all of the best experiments of the best laboratories and the best universities throughout the world. That particular document has something like 1,000 references. American National Standards Institute, that's what I couldn't think of. The American National Standards Institute C95 report is the defining report for the United States, for the OSHA, Department of Defense, NIOSH, and whatever. There is a very similar report published by the United Kingdom. There's a similar report by Japan, by Germany, and essentially all of those reports hang together, in my opinion. Now, this is one of the deeper subjects, Alex, which I recommend that we get into beyond 9:30 tonight. And so we're not going to be discussing it during the early portion, but I'm just giving my quick introduction as to where my opinion is coming from. And I know Alex has other pieces of evidence, and so beyond 9:30 our time, I will get into that. The very first person who had one of the quick questions tonight is Jim. And Jim realizes that this...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Jim in Port Washington realizes that there's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. And before he becomes a year older, he wants to try as many of them as he can. That's what I think he's doing. Enthusiasm like you wouldn't believe. So Which one of the many kinds of ham radio are you going to be addressing tonight, Jim? KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2QIW.
Yeah, QIW recognized. Yeah, Dick, I just had a question today about modulated CW, and I'd gotten this straight key from eBay for $20, and it was a really good deal. And it came, and it didn't come with any connectors, so I went to Radio Shack and I got these connectors, and I just soldered the wire to the connectors in the correct places, and it seemed to work on my 10-meter rig, but I wanted to try to see if I could do modulated CW. I'm going to have to change the connector on the end, but first of all, is there any activity on modulated CW? And second of all, do you think it would be easy to solder a connector to my HD in the speaker and the mic portion of it and do Morse code? Do you think that would be possible? Over to you.
Yeah, you've sort of got two questions there, Jim. Can you do it with a handy talkie? Yes. Would it be popular? I think the answer is no. Let me tell you what modulated CW is as opposed to real CW. In the case of real CW, you are turning on and off a carrier. The carrier is running full blast out of the transmitter. In other words, if I've got a 100-watt transmitter, I'm running 100 watts of power when I'm key down and 0 watts of power when I'm key up. And when that carrier on and off transmitter, a ordinary A1, as we used to call it, A1 type Morse code, CW, is being transmitted, it has a couple of very unique qualities. When you're listening to it with a receiver that has a product detector, the kind of receiver that's made for single sideband or Morse code, and the property of that receiver that's so valuable is that not only does it have a narrow bandwidth and extremely good sensitivity, but it injects a local oscillator by way of that product detector. The local oscillator is being injected, your carrier is being beat against it, and you end up with a tone. And when the human ear is listening to an 800 hertz tone, and by the way, you set the receiver, you can make the tone low or high. Many people adjust it for 600, 800, 1,000 hertz. Your particular hearing has very great sensitivity when it listens to a single tone buried in the noise. A good hearing system can listen to that tone many decibels weaker than the noise. And when you're listening to very weak Morse code, say for instance moon bounce, meteor scatter, and things like that, the really weak signal, long-range techniques, listening to that tone and the noise gives you extremely good sensitivity. In the case of modulated CW, you're now transmitting a signal which has its own carrier, and it's either amplitude modulated or FM modulated. When you go through the study of what kind of sensitivity modulated CW can give you, I'm not sure of the exact number, but if somebody did a complete study and came to the conclusion that modulated CW is 9 decibels less sensitive than ordinary CW, quite possibly that's the real truth, if you know what I mean. These are some of the reasons why modulated CW, it exists, it's a mode that's possible, it's authorized by the FCC, but in my opinion, it is very unpopular. The total number of modulated CW signals I've heard in a lifetime, I can count on 2 hands, if you know what I mean. In some cases, it was a guy doing a 10-gig contact, let me drop. A guy is doing a 10 gigahertz contact on the top of a mountain like Mount Wachusett in Massachusetts. He's doing a 10 gig contact, and he is talking back on the 2-meter liaison frequency. Most of these guys will use 2 meters to set up the contact, find out who's out there, what direction they're at, and then they actually go and make the 10 gig contact. But the guy forgot his Morse code key, and so he's whistling into the microphone or is doing something else that makes a tone in order to tell people on the 2-meter frequency with his FM rig or his sideband rig that he wants to make a QSO on Morse code, and he forgot his Morse code key. So in cases like that, people have done it. But as a mode, it's fairly unpopular. Yes, you could you could do real Morse code with a handy talkie. However, the way the handy talkie works, it turns on and off a frequency synthesizer, and if you ever listened with a single sideband receiver to the turn-on sequence of a handy talkie, you realize that the first half second it comes on the air, it squitters. It goes, pew, if you know what I mean. It makes a funny sound as it comes on the air. And as such, sending Morse code with it would be slightly sloppy sounding Morse code if you were completely turning on and off the key. I've done that on occasion. And I've also heard people send Morse code by pressing the touch tone pads on an FM rig. So it's something you can do in a pinch. But as a popular method of transmitting Morse code and getting to practice with Morse code, it is my opinion it's not popular. Now, there may be other people out there with another opinion. So as I pass it back to you, drag your feet a little bit in case there are other people that have used MCW and love it and are going to tell us how great it is. KC2, Baker Hotel Yankee to take it with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Coming.
Okay, go ahead, Wes.
This is KC2QYW.
Yeah, Mr. QYW, I think that is Joe. And Joe, do you want to be added to the list of people who have got a question? Is that what you're saying, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Dick, and to the net. Yeah, I haven't spoken to you guys in years because I moved. See, I'm in my mobile. I'm in a mobile car, and yeah, you can add me to the list, and in the future, I'll set up my 2 meter in my house. And, hey, it's good hearing you guys.
And, Joe, are you at your home QTH in Harrison, New York?
Yes, that's my QTH, Harrison, New York. Yep, that's true.
Okay, we'll be getting around to you. So on the subject of MCW, it sounds like Wes has got a comment on it, and maybe where you came from, Wes, it's more popular. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Well, in 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and almost 2000, eastern part of Europe, the former communist countries, everything was homemade. One of the biggest problems that they have had is, by international standard, A1 is unmodulated carrier, A2 is modulated carrier, A3 is AM modulation, A3A, A3B, A3J, there is a single sideband. Let me check.
N-Y-2-H.
Okay, so practically major problem that they have the experience was that when they were using A1, which is the unmodulated carrier, was beauty. Could have put 1 kilowatt to give a break. So the power unit of the transmitter wasn't really very much feeling the load. Now, when you have had a modulated carrier, then the power was always there, and the tube was always hot. And then at the top of it, yeah, you are modulating that. So that's a major difference, and my feedback on it. Yes, in Europe, CW is very much popular, much more popular than in here. And the major reason for it is that it was used in the military and was obligatory factor for the soldiers to learn it. And now we have plenty of countries that gained their freedom, but the people young at that time are still here, and they enjoy the ham radio this way. They simply love it. And so it's here.
Excuse me, Dick. Lou has to do a maintenance reset.
You got it, Lou.
Yeah, all right. No, not quite. I actually had a comment. On 147.555 daily, W1AW has co-practice modulated FM.
Yeah, that's
US2N comment.
And Paul recognized. Yeah, it's good to recognize that, Lou. So Morse code is being sent out on many frequencies simultaneously almost every day of the week. they alternate the fast days and the slow days by ARRL as a method for people to practice their Morse code. In the old days, they had to do that practice in order to pass the test. Nowadays, they're doing it for their own personal need because our testing requirement no longer requires Morse code. So when, of all the many frequencies ARRL sends out Morse code, when they send it out on 3.5 megacycle region near there and the 7.0 near megacycle region, there it's real A1 type on-off carrier Morse code. But when they send it out on 147.555, it is tones being sent over an FM transmitter. And you do sacrifice a certain amount of sensitivity, but there, if you're within the right range of ARRL headquarters and getting a good signal at 147 megacycles, the fact that it's not a super weak signal, and you're not trying to operate DX, you're doing it for reasons of code practice, it works out very well. So there's another place where it's being used. Let's see. Who was it now that... Paul wants to make a comment. How often have you used most modulated CW, Paul? Or how often have you heard it, and where have you heard it? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Lockfield used to do it years ago in the 80s. Not as a routine, but they had the simplex net. Ed K2YAW used to run that net. And sometimes you'd have a guy that would be hard to copy. And everybody always had their oscillators, you know, stand by. And once in a while, you would hear somebody send their call letter, you know, because, or maybe they had laryngitis or something. That was pretty much it. They practice a little bit at the end, you know, at the end of the net. A couple of guys might practice, you know, going back and forth a little bit, you know, on not a weekly basis, but, you know, maybe you'd hear it like once a month. But, you know, everybody always had the oscillator. You just pull the trigger on the mic and a guy would send this call like that, you know. And that was pretty much it. But there was nothing really extensive there. But, I mean, even nowadays, they have the simplex in Connecticut. I've done that a couple of times. I've heard a couple of other guys do it as well. Pretty much you call, and that's about it. Back to you, Dick.
I forgot to add that an unmodulated carrier is only 400 hertz, so the crowding band is better. If you compare with A2, A2 is very much similar to A3. So, you know, taking 2.5 kilohertz up to 6 kilohertz depends how wide is the modulation signal. And to AJ.
N2RDB with a question.
N2RDB. Start up with your name, sir. Don't give us your question yet unless you're making a comment on the subject that's on the floor right now. N2RDB, K2RIW. Go ahead.
Name here is Tim, Tango India Mike. No, it's a question relating to antennas. I just wanted to be put on the list.
Very fine, Tim. You're on the list. Alrighty. So as I see it, Jim, it's a fun thing to send Morse code by way of tones being transmitted in the AM or the FM mode over a rig. For practices, it's done. Apparently, it is more popular in Europe than it is in the United States. But as a method of establishing brand new contacts and working DX distance, I think it is, in my opinion, fairly unpopular in the United States, and I'm giving you some of the reasons why I think it is unpopular. Wonder if you're planning to do some more of this, Jim. I guess part of your reason would be methods of sending Morse code on a handy-talkie, and in general, a handy-talkie is not really set up for sending Morse code, although I've seen people whistle into the microphone and key the push-to-talk button as a method of sending Morse code. It's kind of sloppy, but it does work. KD2, Baker Hotel Yankee, K2RIW. You got it, Jim.
Well, thanks, Dick. I'll definitely try and see what I can do with it, but I just have one more very quick question. How much actual A1 CW activity is there on 2 meters?
Of all the 2-meter activity, where FM is probably 85% of it, and 14% of it is a single sideband down at 144-200, the 144-200 horizontally polarized single sideband type guys who are mostly doing DX and meteor scatter and moon bounce and things like that. Well, the moon bounce guys go closer to 144-200 is the calling frequency. So lots and lots of sideband for the guys who are well equipped. But when it comes to a pure Morse code CW, other than moon bounce, I think it's a bit rare. I would guess only a couple of percent, is my guess, of the activity on 2 meters is pure Morse code. And I think the Morse code calling frequency is approximately 144-100. Unless you've got a horizontally polarized Yagi with a reasonably sensitive sideband capability system listening on that band, unless you listen in that mode, and there are particular hours in which those guys look for each other, like maybe 9 o'clock at night on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, if you know what I mean. Other than the particular hours that they know to look for each other, it's not a super popular mode. You can go listening for Morse code signals on 2 meters, and lots of hours of the day you won't hear anything, and you'll think there's no activity. That's a bunch of opinions, but that's what I hear, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Yeah, over to you, over to Net Control, and thanks for the explanation to my question.
And if I know you, Jim, you're going to be doing a little bit more experimenting and looking into it. And if you do find out it is a little bit more popular and you start making some QSOs on modulated CW, come back and tell us about it. The next person on the list was Mike, KA2 Delta Uniform Tango. And what's going on over there in Glen Cove, Mike? You've got it. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone in net. Pretty good in Glen Cove. Quick question. It's a little about ATRS. My other hobby is flying airplanes, and I'm picking up my airplane in Tennessee mid-June. And I'm thinking of something like an ATRS radio or a beacon or a tracking on it. And I guess my first question is, I have a spare aviation antenna, which is probably a 118 to 136 megahertz antenna. Question is, if I get one of those little 5-watt APRS HTs, do you think I could use that antenna? And do you think it would actually work somewhere between 2,500 to 6,500 feet above sea level? Back to you, Dick.
The guys who have driven around the United States with a transmitter not too different from the one you're talking about on their automobile, and their friends were keeping track of where they are by way of APRS and sending them text messages and whatever. So you don't even need the altitude of an aircraft. With the altitude of an aircraft, where you've got ridiculous coverage to all of the access points for APRS, oh, they're going to know exactly where you are, if you know what I mean. That's going to work like a charm. When it comes to an antenna rated for 118 to 136, can you make it work on 146 megacycles, 145 megacycles? Absolutely. Easily. By that I mean the antenna itself. I don't care if it's a whip, a dipole, monopole, a log, whatever kind of antenna it is, scimitar. The kinds of antennas that are put on an aircraft usually are fairly simple, usually omnidirectional. And yes, the antenna, when you use it on 146 megacycles, is going to give you, in its native form, it's going to give you a fairly high standing wave ratio. However, if you're smart enough in building the right kind of impedance matching network, which it'll work better if it's directly at the antenna, but in many cases you can put it at the far end of the transmission line, at the transmitter end. But if you're smart enough to build the right kind of an impedance matching network, you can make that antenna work with 95% efficiency on 146 megs, even though it's not designed for 146 megs. Let me drop. Your bigger problem, you will be able to definitely transmit out of that antenna and receive out of that antenna on 146 megs with the right kind of impedance matching network. Your bigger problem, though, is that when you're transmitting into that antenna, because that antenna is also used for your aircraft hardware, and if you put transmitter power into the front end of the aircraft receiver, that's operating on 118 to 136, that could be bad. So you've got to be a little bit on the careful side here. With the right kind of a duplexer, diplexer, triplexer, multiplexer. In other words, there's going to be an impedance matching filter-like network, hopefully mounted at the antenna, but it could be at the transmission end of the feed line, where you make sure that the amount of signal from your 146 meg transmitter that gets into the other aircraft equipment is small enough, first of all, not to do damage. Second of all, it would be real nice if it's small enough that the other aircraft equipment can continue to work without any detriment in its performance. So the right kind of a filter network giving you enough isolation is really the right way to go. Because the degree of isolation you require in a filter network is relatively difficult to get, whereas with a few feet of spacing between antennas, that number of dB of isolation is very easy to get. It's going to be very tempting, as I see it, Mike, to tell you to put up a completely separate antenna for the APRS, a simple little whip antenna. It could be hanging out the window, above the wing, alongside of the landing gear, whatever. A simple other antenna, completely separate for the 146 meg APRS operation is a nice, easy way to go, and it avoids an awful lot of grief. So without a doubt, it can be done, but you can tell there's a couple of caveats there from my point of view, Mike. KA2, Delta Uniform Tango, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's what I figured, Dick. They are two separate. I mean, I do have two separate comm antennas. I have one comm unit that's obviously VHF AM, you know, aircraft. And the second one I was going to set up for a second, like, handheld aviation radio, but I might just combine that and try that with a Yaesu or a Kenwood APRS. But, yeah, the other thing was, too, I was thinking the same thing, just hanging something off the duct taping it on my landing gear or something like that and trying that. But that's great advice. Is there a tuner? I know I feel like MFJ has some antenna tuners for 2 meter. Is there anything else you suggest?
And you didn't finish the sentence. Is there anything else I can suggest other than an antenna tuner to do what? Is it you want to use the antenna tuner to take a 118 to 136 meg antenna and operate it on 146? Is that where you want to use the antenna tuner? Or is it that you're thinking of setting up a completely separate antenna specialized for 146 megs, in which case I'm not sure you would need a tuner? Back to you for that one, Mike.
Yeah, sorry about that, Dick. Yeah, I mean, the antenna matcher to match to the aviation antenna. Now, I know if I had a 2 meter antenna, I would just have that hanging on the side of the landing gear. But, yeah, I think MFJ or someone has a simple, some sort of tuner that maybe I could tune the resonance of aircraft antenna to the 2 meter. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you can tune the aircraft antenna and make it resonate at 146 megs. But the tuner is not going to protect your other equipment. Where's the filter function and isolation function going to come from to make sure that the, let me pick a number, 5 watts or 50 watts of power on 2 meters is not going to be getting into the aircraft equipment? If they're both connected to the same antenna, things connected to the same thing are connected to each other. So the tuner is not necessarily going to give you the protection so that the 50 watts doesn't go roaring into the front end of your other aircraft equipment. Back to you on that one, Mike.
So you're saying that even if they're on separate antennas, I have two aircraft antennas, I have my aircraft radio on, say, antenna 1, and I'm using aircraft antenna 2 isolated strictly to the 2-meter rig, there could be some... I mean, I'm sure there could always be some RF interference, obviously, because of the proximity of the antennas being about a foot and a half apart from each other. But they're not... There's no duplex, or they're not connected, per se, to the same antenna. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine. If those two antennas are completely mechanically separated from each other for those two separate functions, APRS plus the other aircraft functions, then with cross-polarization, with distance, with different locations on the aircraft, you can get all kinds of decibels of isolation that you want. No real problem on that one. On top of that, the 2-meter antenna, to build a quarter-wave ground plane on 2 meters where the whip, if you don't shrink it down with electronic techniques, would be 19 inches long, and it could be built on a coat hanger wire, to build or buy a completely separate 2-meter antenna that is well-tuned for 146 megs and you mount it on the landing gear or whatever, it requires no tuner. So, yes, maybe you have fallen in love with an aircraft-type antenna. You've got a second one, but it's tuned for 118 to 136 megs. and you want to use it on 146 megs, yes, a tuner there would do that. So the only reason why that would be justified from my point of view of the tuner plus that antenna is if you believe that that antenna is so well mechanically aircraft qualified that it can survive rain erosion, ice, snow, weatherproof, and whatever. It's a real aircraft rugged antenna as opposed to a homebrew thing. But with a little bit of skill, you could make the homebrew 2-meter antenna as rugged as you like, buy or build, and no tuner required. So those are some of your choices. But yes, you're absolutely right. No real isolation would be required. Isolating filtering would be required as long as you have reasonable mechanical separation. When in doubt, you can either model this, although it's not an easy thing to model, or you can actually measure. When in doubt, the nicest thing to do is to really measure. In other words, squeeze a signal generator at 146 megs into the APRS antenna at the exact same time that some kind of instrumentation, like a spectrum analyzer, is looking at what's coming out of the aircraft antenna that would have ordinarily gone in to the air...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Measure the real leakage between the antennas. Measure how much signal at 146 megs comes out of the connector for the 118 to 136 that's going into the aircraft equipment. So actually measure the amount of signal there. And let me pick a number. If it's minus 10 dBm when you're transmitting 10 watts, then you're in like Flynn. So you can measure the number of decibels of isolation without too much difficulty. And even if you don't own the right kind of instrumentation, you talk to some of the guys on this particular repeater who have got all kinds of repeater, or all kinds of instrumentation, all kinds of test equipment in their laboratory. You beg, borrow, steal, whatever, you can actually make that measurement. So when in doubt, you can measure the isolation and know ahead of time whether or not it is going to be giving you electromagnetic interference. The nicest performance of all would be where each piece of equipment can run 100% of the time, and each doesn't even know the other one is present. With the right amount of isolation and the right amount of filtering, you can get there. Come back and let us know how this works out, Mike, because you're one of the few guys that's into both ham radio and aircraft, and that's a pretty rare breed. By that I mean one human being per 500 in the general population has a private pilot license. One human being in the general population has a ham radio license. Under normal circumstances, the human beings in the general population that have both licenses are only a few guys per million. You're a rare breed, Mike. K-A-2-D-U-T, K-2-R-I-W.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much, Dick, for the information. For sure, I'm sure the final experiment will be to see if it actually works, and I'm leaving Memphis, Tennessee, and coming back this way. But, yeah, awesome. Thank you for the information, and we're going to add some more things once we get back to New York. I have an HF trailing antenna, wire antenna, and some other ideas to do some HF work just during the day. Sometimes going up, but that's a whole other discussion. We'll wait for the plane to get back to New York. I just want to get past the APRS for now. Thank you very much for all your stuff, and we'll throw it back to you, Dick.
And just so that we could do a little bit more drooling, Mike, what is the model number and year of manufacture of that beautiful aircraft that you now own?
My airplane's a 1970 Cessna 150. It's actually an Alpha 150 Kilo. It's an aerobatic. I do aerobatics in it. And just got all new paint, glass, antennas, smoke system, all strobes. So you're going to definitely see me over at Jones Beach or somewhere this year. I missed the air show this year, but you'll see me soon. I'll get some HF stuff to it, and we'll get into that when I get the plane back. But for now, I'm just trying to get to see if I can get an APRS tracker with a little 2-meter working up there. That'd be kind of fun. If you QRZ me, there's some links to some things of me landing on a frozen lake up in New Hampshire and some other things. So there's other fun stuff. So should be a blast. And hopefully I'll be able to talk on that in the TechNet from about 3,000 feet. Back to you, Dick.
I have flown in a Cessna 150. Didn't solo in one, but as I said, I've flown in one. Very good. Fun type airplane. A very popular airplane at one time. Next person on the list with a real question, I think, is going to be Tim. I'm pretty sure that Wes has one of the more complicated questions. Let me make a quick check. Wes, do you have what you believe is one of these quick questions that's appropriate for this time, as opposed to the deeper questions that you very frequently get into? N2XJN, K2RIW.
You got it right, Dick. Very simple question.
you explain why CW goes further than a single sideband? Single sideband goes further than A3, which would be amplitude modulation. And to exceed.
Yeah, let's start off with amplitude modulation, A3. In the case of amplitude modulation, if I was building a 100 watt AM transmitter, the usual rule of thumb is the carrier power out of the final stage is capable under normal circumstances of producing 100 watts, and if it was a high level modulator, which really means you've got the equivalent of a audio output transformer that's adjusting the high voltage to the plate of the final tube. I'm going back to tube explanations here. And during the time that the usual rule of thumb is that the audio capability must be one-half of the power of the RF. So if it's a 100-watt transmitter, I must produce 50 watts, half of 100 watts, of audio power. The secondary winding of that 50-watt audio amplifier is changing the plate voltage on the tube. And if the plate normally is running at 1,000 volts, when I speak into the microphone at full amplitude, I'll be going between 2,000 volts and 0 volts. The B plus will go through the secondary winding to the plate of the tube, and so the plate amplitude goes up and down twice normal voltage during the peaks of audio and down to 0. And the bottom line, when you put it all together, is that you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, I will see a continuous 100-watt carrier that does not get modulated. And during the time that I'm talking into it, if I simply whistle into the microphone with a 1 kilohertz note, there'll be an upper side band, a kilohertz higher than the carrier, and a lower side band, a kilohertz lower than the carrier, and each of those side bands will be 6 decibels weaker than the carrier. The total amount of power in those two side bands will be 50 watts. When the receiver is receiving that composite amplitude modulated signal, believe it or not, inside of your final envelope detector.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
In the final IF stage of the AM receiver, the final IF stage envelope detector, literally is beating those two sidebands against the carrier, and therefore the envelope goes up and down in amplitude. The carrier demodulation picks up the audio of that envelope and sends it to the audio amplifier and eventually goes to the loudspeaker or to the earphones, and that's what you hear. As long as the signal is nice and strong, that system works like a charm. At super threshold weak signals, you're now getting a whole lot of noise in the IF strip by comparison, and that the carrier that must be beat against the upper and lower sideband in order to make the envelope modulation that your envelope detector of the receiver sees, because the noise is contaminating the carrier as well as the information on the side lobes. You start losing threshold in weak signal conditions real fast. In the case of single sideband, the single sideband doesn't transmit the carrier.
It does.
But the receiver injects the carrier. Because the carrier is being locally injected into the demodulation stage, the product detector of a single sideband receiver, by definition, the carrier being re-injected, which must beat against the side lobes that contain the information, one or two side lobes, depending on whether it's a double sideband or a single sideband transmitter, because the carrier is locally injected and it's nice and strong and pure, that portion of desensitization has been removed. On top of that, the sideband receiver, the sideband transmitter, only occupies half the bandwidth. The receiver only occupies half the bandwidth if the receiver has been properly optimized for that system. Therefore, you pick up 3 dB of improvement because of bandwidth. You pick up some number of other dB of improvement because of what you transmit in power, where you're not wasting power on the carrier. The carrier is required to get good demodulation, but the carrier does not itself convey information. So therefore, you put it all together. Because of these individual advantages and disadvantages, you put it all together, and the usual rule of thumb is that single sideband has approximately 7 to 9 decibels of increased sensitivity compared to AM. And now Morse code has an extreme improvement above single sideband capability when the signal is not being, amplitude modulated because of Doppler fading of the moon or whatever. Under normal circumstances, Morse code, because you can use an extremely narrowband receiver, has a significant number of dB of improvement over sideband. So, in the order of sensitivity, AM is the least sensitive, sideband is probably 7 to 9 dB.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Sideband is probably 7 to 9 dB more sensitive, and Morse code is probably an easy 10 dB more sensitive than that. It's a function of where's the energy, who's injecting the carrier, and how narrowband is the receiver. That's some of the information, Wes. By the way, awful glad that your Kenwood 2000 is repaired because your audio sounds a lot better out of that Kenwood than it did with Echolink. N2XJN. I'm pretty sure you can override this guy, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm good, too. Just waiting for a quick. He's just waiting for a quick. I'm not going to get it.
You.
By the way, that signal is 60 dB over S9 on the input at my QTH. Over to you, Wes.
Okay. There is another factor. You have 3 dB is gain because of the narrow filter of the receiver. The total gain is estimated about 16 dB, but... the carrier is present. It is 3% of the carrier in A3J. A3J. C and A3J. That's what I know about. And also, the factor of power concentration. If we have just the carrier, which is A1, then all of the power is concentrated on the carrier. And since there is no modulation, the width of the signal is only 400 hertz. But I'm going to risk another hypothesis that you can compare it to the weight applied on the needle. The more narrow is the more narrow is the object, the further it goes. Like you try to push your finger against your hand, and then you just feel the pressure. But if you try to push with the same pressure the needle, it goes from the other side of your hand. And again.
Yeah, that is a good example. A needle has a lot of similarity to a very narrow band signal on a spectrum analyzer. By the way, the width of a Morse code signal could approach 10 hertz of width depending on the speed that you're sending the Morse code. The width of the signal on a Morse code transmitter is only as wide as the number of words per minute that you're transmitting. And there's a formatter in between there, of course. If you're transmitting very slow speed Morse code, then the signal can become extremely narrow. And so there are techniques by which, with a phase lock loop-like system, where you electronically make the receiver extremely narrow, it can listen to extremely weak signals. That's what is taking place when NASA is listening to the Voyager spacecraft, which is 2 or 3 times the distance of Pluto out there. They're using a phase lock loop receiver system, which has a bandwidth of only a few hertz of width, to listen to the equivalent of digital data, which is very slow-speed Morse code, so to speak. So very, very narrow. When it comes to single sideband, lots and lots of additional threshold extension techniques are possible by properly speech processing, by using the right kind of bandwidth enhancing techniques on the receiver. Sideband has got a lot of extra threshold. I've heard numbers as high as 9 and under some circumstances even more than that compared to AM. Amplitude modulation, which some of the more aggressive amateurs will call it antique modulation, although it's got a nice round sound to it. And by the way, with the right kind of equipment, single sideband can have all the fidelity of AM. But because many of the rigs that we use have a not so well designed speech processing network and filters that are not so well designed that have ringing characteristics to them, quite often the single sideband on a slightly misset receiver has a number of distortions that we tune our ear and our brain system when we learn to live with it. But know that sideband is capable of full fidelity. Know that for years and years, the telephone circuits that you were listening to that had what you thought was very good speech quality to it, that actual signal getting to your telephone was a single sideband signal when there really were repeater networks of RF energy in the system in the early days. Now it's all being done with fiber. And now the next question is the fiber single sideband? No, it's not. It's a digital technique. So there's a lot to be learned about the various kinds of modulation. And when it comes to really weak signal threshold techniques, the Joe Taylor, WSJT techniques, K1JT, Joe Taylor, he has come up with techniques where you can send something like Morse code, and the signal can be 28 decibels weaker than the noise of that receiver, and it will print the message across the screen with 95% reliability, if you know what I mean. So there are some very fancy techniques for very weak signal, Morse code-like techniques. Now, you could say the Joe Taylor technique is a kind of modulated CW, because that technique consists of a combination of four tones. But you got to be careful now. Those tones are not AM modulated tones with carrier and sidebands to them. They are four individual, what you and I would call tones. They are as if you had four individual CW transmitters that are being turned on in the right combinations. That's what's really going on in that system. So it's got a lot going for it. And we've only just barely scratched the surface on this one, Wes. There's a lot more to be discussed. Let me go on to the next guy, and we'll come back to that. Okay, the next person on our list was, I think, Tim. WA2 Romeo Delta... WA2 Romeo Delta Bravo, if I've got it down, written down here correctly, Tim. Go right ahead with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. The call sign is November 2 Romeo Delta Bravo, N2RDB. How am I coming in?
Very well, Tim. Please proceed.
Thank you, Dick. Anyway, of late, I've become interested in NVIS communications, and I was trying to figure out basically the best type of an antenna setup for that. You know, I've looked at simple wire dipoles, I've looked at the buddy pole system, and I found out that you could get a pair of ham stick antennas, and there was actually a bracket made where you could set that up as a horizontal dipole and use that for NVIS communication. Well, I went out and I bought not one pair, but two pair of WIPs. One for 40 meters and one that was labeled for 75 meter use. So I had tried chaining two pair of them together. There seemed to be some unfavorable interaction between them, so I tried tuning them up singly. I'll let it drop for a moment. Now, with the 40 meter hamstick whip, I was able to get a fairly good, how shall I say, if you could think in terms of a 2-to-1 VSWR bandwidth, we would be talking about 150 kilohertz, which is not too bad for that kind of antenna. Now, I tried to tune up the 75-meter pair. My goal was to aim for the upper portion of the band, voice portion of the band, and something very interesting happened. I'll let it drop for a moment. I had expected that the bandwidth
the 2-to-1 Vizwar bandwidth would be significantly less than with the 40-meter pair of antennas. Now, the results I got, if I tuned up to the lower portion of the band, I got about a 50 kilohertz bandwidth, and best case SWR of about 1.2 to 1. And I said, okay, I can shorten up the whips on this, and it should just shift me up the band, right? Wrong. What happened to my VSWR was it got progressively worse, and when I went to the upper portion of the band, say like 3.7, 3.8 megahertz, I was getting like a 3 or a 4 to 1 SWR resulting in that. That was best case, never mind any bandwidth. So I had to tune the antenna up for the lower portion of the band to get any sort of, usable results. Now, of course, I do have an MFJ-941 tuner, and I understand with that thing you could basically tune up anything. You could tune up a wet noodle on that. But putting that to the side for the moment, I was kind of hoping to get at least partial band results without a tuner. Now, to solve my 80-meter problem, one would think that capacitance would have to be added someplace. Now, if so, how would I go about doing that? Would I use one of those devices they call a capacitance hat? So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Once again, the disruptive signal is 60 dB over S9 at MyQTH on the input. What you're getting into, first of all, there's two separate issues here. The Nevis function that you desire, which means you want to aim the signal straight up in the air almost. And second of all, you want to take the hamstick antennas and move them to the right frequency. And what happens when you move antennas to a different frequency by adjusting length or use different impedance matching? There is an article that's going to help you an awful lot. And that article, you're going to find it on the bottom of Tom Williams' page. If you go to the website of WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.org. This is the microwave website of Dr. Tom Williams. On the bottom of that page, you'll find Yagi information by KQRIW. And you click on that, and you'll find three things there. Two graphs and an article, a 1,500-word article. The 1,500-word article is going to explain an awful lot of this to you. By the time you read that article the second or third time, Tim, it's going to make a lot more sense. But I'm going to give you a quick summary right now. Let me drop. And that is, if this was a simple whip antenna, quarter wave radiated above a ground plane, which is not exactly what you've got. The hamstick has got all kinds of other doodads and spiral winding and whatever to make it more compact. But if it was a simple whip antenna, curve number one, the resistor component of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, back in 1968, spent a month of their life measuring every possible diameter and length of a monopole antenna, measured the exact impedance, resistive and reactive component. Way back in those days, they didn't have a network analyzer. These guys had to do it the hard way with a slide rule and a slotted line and a Vizwar detecting circuit, and it's a lot of work. So they put months of work into drawing those curves. But the bottom line of those curves are that as you change the length of the radiator, if it's a simple wire radiator of some given diameter, and the curves are all for different diameters there, as you change the length of the wire, you can simply make the resistive component go anywhere from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms, inclusive, by doing nothing but changing the length of the wire. As the wire gets shorter, the resistive component gets smaller. As the wire gets longer, the resistive component gets larger. That's a given. So once you choose the right length of wire so that the resistive component is 50 ohms, you think you're home free. That's only half the story. For your length of wire, there's almost always a reactive component left over. And once you put a shunt capacitor or a shunt inductor across the base or in series with the base of a monopole antenna, you've got a perfect impedance match. So no matter what frequency you're on, making a perfect impedance match on a monopole-like antenna with a full-size ground plane is duck soup. Now, in your world, you're using a hamstick, which means you've got not an infinite kind of ground plane.